Hello and welcome to the podcast that brings you guys the chat about wildlife, animals and nature. It is Into the Wild. I am your host, I am Ryan Dalton. This week's episode is all about eagles, eels and elephants. And as always, it's not just my voice you're going to be hearing, guys. I have two wonderful guests. I have stand-up comedian and actor Eric Lawler, and I have animal expert and, I've been told to say this, Twitter sensation Ruth Fitzpatrick. Very excitingly, I was recording this episode from Dublin, so let's tell you a bit about how my last 10 days have been since the last episode. I was in Dublin for 7 days. I was doing loads of shows, I was doing lots of gigs, did a few radio interviews. I did a lot of drinking, and I met up with Eric. Eric's a good friend of mine. He's a stand-up comedian based in Dublin, and so he came down to be on the podcast, share his thoughts on animals, and also I met Ruth. Ruth actually met on Twitter through all our animal chat that we kind of get involved, you know, how the social media world works. And on my very first full day in Dublin, it was a beautiful day, it was blue skies and 24 degrees, Ruth agreed to meet me at Dublin Zoo, and she very kindly took me around the whole grounds. Now, it turns out that she told me a lot of information that I did not listen to because I was staring at a chimp. Now, that this happens with Ryan's brain, guys. Sometimes Ryan looks at an animal so focused that everything else switches off. So I was very happy to have Ruth on the episode so she could remind me of all the information she was telling me. I do apologise, Ruth. And we were actually recording this episode in the hostel I was staying at, which is Isaac's Hostel, and I just want to give them a shout because they were absolutely brilliant. Now, we were in quite a large room, so I do apologise in advance. I think the sound quality on this episode might be a bit echoey. I think bits of it might be a bit quiet. I do apologise for that. We did the best of what we had around us. But it's a great chat. There's really good bits of information. I learned a lot from Ruth on this episode, especially about eels. Ruth had great knowledge about eagles as well. And also, wonderful fact about elephant feet. Wait for that towards the end of the podcast. It's so cool. There's one more thing I've got to warn you guys. Now, I was in Dublin. I had a show. We recorded this on Monday. I had a show Sunday evening. And I went out and I might have had a few shandies on the Sunday evening. And I'm not going to lie to you guys. I was a little bit hungover whilst recording this episode. So if you hear my voice being a bit croaky or I stutter my words a little bit, let's blame the Guinness, shall we? The Guinness hangover. So, oh God, I'm going to sound terrible on this now. But enjoy it. It's a great episode. There's some great bits of information. And I will talk to you guys at the end. Enjoy it. Here is episode 5, Eagles, Eels and Elephants with myself, Eric Lawler and Ruth Fitzpatrick. Hello and welcome to another episode of Into the Wild. I am your host, Ryan Dalton. Very excitingly, I am recording live from a hostel in Dublin because I'm here for the week doing shows. How amazing is that? You probably don't care. But I'm here doing another episode. This episode today is titled Eagles, Eels and Elephants. And as always, I'm joined by two guests. I am with our animal expert, Ruth Fitzpatrick, and stand-up comedian, Eric Lawler. Thank you so much for both coming down.
Hello.
Thanks for having us, Ryan.
Are you excited to talk about animals, both?
I would be a bit more excited if you had also said I was an actor as well, but that's okay.
Yeah, I expect it, yeah.
I felt some tension in the room for a bit.
I was going, who is this guy?
I did say that I was Twitter sensation as well. Twitter sensation.
Guys, we're 30 seconds in, and I've already pissed off the Irish again.
It's fine.
But we are recording live from Isaac's hostel, and we're going to be talking loads about wildlife. But first, let's get to know our guests a little bit more. So, Ruth,
yes.
Thank you so much. Also, thank you. You took me around Dublin Zoo the other day.
I did, yes. It seems we have just discovered that you weren't really listening to me while we were going around Dublin Zoo.
We have learned that when there's animals in front of Ryan's face, he does not listen to anything.
No, we did. I thought at the time that we had a wonderful time. and we've learned that. But I have some great news because on the way here, an old woman saw me looking at my notes. And she said that she'd say a prayer for us. So this podcast now has divine intervention.
That is the most lovely thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Right, so it's been blessed.
She was taking notes.
No, I was just having a look because I'm really worried that I say leptocephalus wrong. So I was reading leptocephalus a few times and she...
Listeners can't see Eric's face right now, but it's...
And so she looked at me and said, oh, you're doing an exam today? And I said, no, I'm going on to a podcast and I'm talking about eels. And she said, oh, I'm going to Mass, I'll say a prayer for you. And I was like,
oh,
thanks.
Wow. That is the sweetest.
Regardless of whatever you had just said, yeah, she was still going to Mass to say a prayer for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to get my hair done. I'm going
so
to
say a prayer for you.
Yeah.
And then we went to Phoenix Park and you showed me all the deer there. And you're telling me how you used to do deer tagging.
Yes, yeah, I used to go around Phoenix Park with a giant net. It's a very interesting thing to do in an urban park, to be going around kind of the more secretive areas as quietly as you can, 10 people with giant nets, and then suddenly you come across a couple of people who didn't realise that if they turned around there was going to be 10 people surrounding them with giant nets. But,
family picnic ruined.
Yeah. Not quite.
Not so
that
much family picnic.
Yeah. Oh, is it not quite that?
Yeah,
it's sometimes known as a meeting point.
Yeah.
Oh, look at my innocent brain working.
Or sometimes you'd see people, and like I was also quite young, so I didn't always understand. Like I thought people were just generally very interested in collecting different kinds of mushrooms for,
yes,
culinary
purposes. Or we're incredibly warm and need to take some clothes off.
And as the two of us know, you sometimes need to go find a toilet in Phoenix Park, so we also caught a few of the people short.
Yes, okay, wow.
Tell me why you were in Phoenix Park with giant nets.
To catch the fawns during the fawning season to...
What? To catch them? For what?
So take blood samples, hair samples for genetic reasons, and then also to tag them.
Oh, for genuine...
I wasn't just arriving with a giant net.
I was going, that's taking kids out. You know, you can go to the jar and catch a wasp. I was going, that's an extreme level of catching wasps. Going
it is.
Giant net catching fawns.
No, yeah, no, the fawns, like you try and get them in the first 24 hours and they don't really move all that much. After 2 or 3 days, they start hopping about and it does get a bit more difficult. And there was one time that I was telling Ryan about that I heard a rustling in the bushes and I was like, okay, great. And I went really quietly and like got my net ready to catch it. And when it ran out, only what ran out was actually a stag, not a baby one.
Oh, Christ.
And it required a lot of maneuvering
around.
Because
you've just spooked a giant male animal.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, they're not too big, but I still wouldn't have liked one.
They're bigger than, like Eric said, a wasp. So
But
that's cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on. So you're going to be our... I've labelled you our animal expert.
And from now on, I'm carrying that.
And you carry it.
Yeah.
Ride that wave. Yeah. See where it takes you.
Stick that onto your Twitter bio.
Yeah.
I will. I'll put it right beside.
I think it's already on there now. Yeah. our second guest, Eric Lauder, a comedian, actor.
Thanks very much.
Well.
I'll
re-edit that and put that at the beginning. thank you so much for coming on
it's
today.
It's an absolute honour, Ryan. I haven't seen you since the last time I saw you doing stand up in Dublin.
I was going to say it's been a couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's also nice to catch up. Yeah. Which I'm back at the Crunch tonight.
Are you really?
Yeah. Wow. I'm going back down there.
I'm not on there.
Oh, so that's the end of that.
Yeah, I'll be there.
So how have you been in the last 2 years?
Very good, Ryan. My life has changed because I did get a part on RTE's flagship drama show, Fair City, which is our EastEnders, our Coronation Street.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
I play an absolute prick, and it's so much fun.
Very good.
And the people of Ireland haven't been shy to tell me what an absolute prick I am.
Really? Do you get a lot in the street?
Quite a surreal thing. You know, I was doing the Galway Comedy Festival there a few months ago, and walking around Eyre Square, and a group of middle-aged women came out of a shopping centre, and they saw me, and they went, my God. Are you that arsehole from Fair City? How do you answer that other than yes?
That's good. Have a lovely day.
Well, then you just get a photograph taken with them, and they're delighted. And they go, "Oh my God, you're not like your character." No, yeah, thank you.
It's a character.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. Well, that's great, man.
Yeah,
how's stand up going? You're doing all the festivals.
Stand up is fantastic. Yeah, but I've a lot of festivals coming up this summer. Doing all the Electric Picnic, Casapalooza, the Groove Festival.
Are you going up to the Fringe at all?
No, I'm not going to go. I might go up for a couple of days. I might do one or two of the Best of Irish compilation shows on the stand, which are always lovely shows to do.
Yeah,
but I did the whole run once back in 2011. And because I think it's a rite of passage for every comedian to do. You need to do it at least once.
Yeah,
you know?
You do.
And I did it, and I loved every minute of it. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do in terms of mental and physical energy. But I came back, I have to say, feeling bulletproof.
Really?
You know? Yeah, absolutely. But the one thing that was really weird for me was because When I speak in my normal Dublin accent at my normal speed in Dublin, surrounded by Dublin people understand me, but what the British people don't really understand me, and I reckon half of your people never understand me.
I think we just lost about 20 listeners. Just going, I'm going out.
So, what I had to do, because I've gone to Britain a few times to do gigs, and what I need to do is slow down and enunciate my words, or the British people might as well think I'm speaking
just a completely different light.
Whatever, what is he speaking about? So I had to, when I went to Edinburgh, the first three or four nights were all about me slowing down and enunciating my words. And what it does is it really fucks up your natural rhythms and your timing.
Yeah, I bet, because your delivery is so, especially yourself, you're a storyteller,
So I had to slow it down. But I did it. For three or four days, I forced myself to do it. And the shows then took off. It was great. I mean, I had a really, really good fringe. With great crowds. I actually came back with money in my pocket, which is very strange.
That's
fringe.
You should get a separate award just for that.
Survivor award. Yeah. But and I remember the first show I had back in Ireland afterwards was the Electric Picnic Festival, and I walked out on stage in the massive tent in front of about 1,500 people, but I was still in Edinburgh mode, and I was like, hello everybody, my name is Eric Lawler, and all the comics side stage were going, oh my god,
what's it?
Eric's had a stroke. but then sort of clicks in your head, and you go, oh, I'm back home, I've gone, spin it right back up.
Well,
again.
The whole 1,500 people go, who's this British guy?
I used to like Eric Lawler.
Yeah, it's changed. Well, no, thank you so much for coming down. I really appreciate you being on the show. One thing I haven't asked you both so far, Ruth, favourite animal and why?
Okay, probably the Greenland shark.
Greenland shark?
Wow. Because it lives until, possibly has a maximum age of 500 or 600.
What?
Really?
And reaches sexual maturity at 125.
This
so there's hope for all of us, you know. I'm coming into the late 20s now, and so, like, you know.
So, quarter of his age, he's not sexually mature.
Yeah, I mean, like, that wouldn't be, like, I mean.
And what was the name of the
Greenland shark.
Greenland shark. I've never even heard of that.
Has toxic blood as well, which a lot of Arctic.
It's an Arctic shark.
Okay. It doesn't have a dorsal fin because obviously it's under ice.
Yeah, it's under ice, yeah.
But they grow huge. They are massive.
Wow.
But yeah, I like them. They're almost entirely blind because they...
Again, very deep water.
Yeah, but it's 90% of them have been found with parasites directly on their eyes. So when you see pictures of them, you always see this kind of... they're basically like fluke worms.
Oh, really?
Your eyes. But because they don't...
Sorry, Eric's face again is just an absolute...
They sound very sad.
But you see, because they're in the oceans, they're deep beneath the ice, they don't need to see, so they never have to evolve a way to get rid of these parasites.
Yeah.
So they're just, you know...
I suppose if they could see, they wouldn't stay there to go somewhere nicer.
Maybe they become sexually mature when they're 80. Like,
But that's true, yeah. They just put up, that's almost like a functioning relationship between two animals, I guess. If they don't need the eyesight, parasites work, it's not killing anyone.
Yeah. But I do think it's just amazing that, like, you know, there was when Martin Luther was pushing up, you know, his tenants on the cathedral door, there could have been a Greenland shark born that he's still alive and he's outlived, you know.
That's incredible. I had no idea of that. That is amazing. Okay, that is a top good animal.
Yeah.
Eric.
I'm gonna Google that now.
I'm gonna Google it this afternoon. I'm not really all about this animal.
It featured on Human Planet, that one with John Hirsch.
We've got an episode coming up, which is gonna be about sharks, so I'm gonna do a special feature on that.
Yeah, you should.
Because I've never even heard of that.
Skype me, I'll
Skype. Yeah.
A few better facts. Yeah.
Eric, your favourite animal and why?
It's a lot more basic than the Greenland shark, but it's still quite an exotic animal because I wouldn't have seen him too much only in the zoo. But I love the giraffe.
We were talking about this.
I love the giraffe. I just love his and her grace.
Yes.
They just look. I don't know. Every time I go to a nature reserve, I go to a zoo, or whatever, and I see a giraffe. Mm-hmm. I just feel all calm and kind of. They are like the modern day brontosaurus with the long neck. And they just seem to eat leaves and nothing seems to faze them. I've never seen an angry giraffe. Have you ever seen an angry giraffe?
I have.
You
have? Yeah.
How? What?
We had a bachelor group, so we had young males together. So there's a lot of necking and fighting. But that's what you want. That's the reason why we had them, was to try and get them to learn the dominant behaviour and to see how to be a giraffe, I guess. But I wouldn't say angry, maybe just... a bit agitated. It's not really anger.
Yeah, well, it's testosterone.
And testosterone, yeah. Language, yeah. It's boys being testosterone, like, being in the wildlife. Yeah, I know, yeah, that's, yeah, not really the good thing to say.
It's
boys
not
being boys.
Thing to say.
Yeah, but in the wild, but in the wildlife, in sure, the wild, in the animal kingdom, that kind of is the way, yeah, it works. It's not in, not,
I mean,
in humans.
I mean,
but
even like in Dublin Zoo and African Plains, you sometimes will see one kind of kicking.
Yes.
Ostrich that came a little bit close, you know.
Yeah.
Really.
They can, yeah, but they are. I get what you mean.
Them,
our,
yeah,
last
but
episode.
They just, yeah, they just think they calm me. They calm, yeah, me. Always calm me.
Yeah.
Like, I love. I look at giraffes all, mm-hmm, day, and when these documentaries are on, these, mm-hmm, natural, these nature documentaries, and if it features giraffes, I'm,
yeah,
I'm there with them.
Yeah,
oh,
definitely.
I love this. Man. I love this.
Our last episode was about giraffes, and we were saying the reason why. Because we all on the episode just said we just love them, and I think it's because they just they don't look like anything else.
No,
they're just, you can't. Yeah. Same with rhinos and animals like that. They're just so distinctive to what they are.
Yeah,
they're great.
Absolutely. I mean, you would freak out if you saw a different coloured giraffe, wouldn't you? I mean, everyone knows the shape of the giraffe, but if you,
yeah,
saw, like, say, a red or black one walk out, you'd be like,
"What
just
the hell?" Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true. That is very true. Cool. So very good animals. Right. This is what the next bit of this podcast we do: nature news. Now, usually, I prepare something.
But were out drinking last night.
But I was in Dublin, and when in Rome.
Yes.
So, Ruth, you have prepared some nature news for us. Well, you've,
yeah,
got a headline.
I've,
so.
Well, yeah, no, I've prepared it more than you have. Let's put it that way. Yeah, no, this was a study which was published in kind of the journals at the end of last year and is sort of making its way now into the more mainstream news, which is that honeybees recognise the number zero, which doesn't sound massive, but the right thing is, zero is quite an abstract concept. So we know a lot of animals can count, sometimes not very high, but honeybees have definitely been observed to count up to four. And that's possibly to do with direction, and to know how to get to and from places to be able to count. So the study was done in RMIT University in Melbourne. They trained them to see cards with one to four shapes on it, trained half the groups to go to the one that had the more shapes on it,
mm-hmm,
and another group to go to the one that had less shapes on it. And if they went to the correct one, they got a sugary treat.
Yeah.
And once they had been trained up to a level of 80% accuracy, they then brought in the cards that had zero shapes on it, so no shapes. And they were still getting 69% accuracy.
Wow.
So the ones who were trained to go to ones with less shapes went to the one with zero shapes on it, and the ones who were trained to go to more went to the ones with shapes rather than the ones with zero.
Wow.
So it's kind of a weird one in terms of how intelligent animals are, because we can only test them in the sphere of human intelligence, because humans are setting the tests. Like, if an octopus was setting a test, we'd probably do quite badly.
It's that old Darwin phrase going, like, intelligence, it depends. Like, if you judge intelligence by a fish's ability to climb a tree, then a fish is stupid.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's how you're testing
exactly,
it. Exactly,
yeah. So in a way, no, it's not necessarily, this doesn't necessarily show that bees are more clever than we thought, but it's kind of more showing this kind of, a lot more animals can do a lot more things.
Yeah, yeah.
Than we gave them credit for. So that even just the counting, lots of birds can count. We now know that bees can count, including things that we thought of was quite abstract. We now know that a lot more animals have a much more broad emotional range. So it's all of these studies. It just brings it's more than anything. It's making more questions. It doesn't answer anything.
Yeah, it just opens up a new book, doesn't it?
But it's just really changing the goalposts, and it's changing our conception of what an animal is and what their intelligences are and what they can do.
Okay, well, that's really cool. So they're recognising that number.
The lack of number.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Okay, amazing. Well, thank you so much for prepping that.
You're welcome.
Great. So what we're going to do is go on to our first animal, or group of animal rather, which is the eagles. Now, guys, how do you feel about eagles? Do you like eagles?
I do.
I'm a big fan of eagles.
I said earlier on that I was in Taylor Park last week, which is a theme park which is dedicated to potatoes. Here in Ireland, of course it is, you know.
Yeah.
And,
I did actually tell him about Taylor Park, but we were looking at lions,
so I probably repeated
all. He wasn't listening to me.
Right. So Taylor Park,
as I subsequently learned from your good self, that it is, what is it? It's not licensed to.
Well, no. Maybe don't repeat that.
Let's not repeat that. But anyway, let's not repeat that. It's a beautiful area. No,
it is beautiful. It is beautiful. It's very good and educational.
It's a theme park, roller coasters, all that kind of stuff. But they have a really, really extensive animal reserve there as well.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And I saw tigers, and I saw a big, massive collection of eagles.
Wow.
And I mean. After the giraffe, now I would say the eagle would be one of my favorite animals.
Yeah,
I love looking at them because they look so noble, so old, and so knowledgeable. And I always, when I'm looking at an eagle and an eagle's looking back at me, I'm always the one who's feeling being judged.
Yeah. And I think that's because eagles have fascinating eyes, and they really are concentrating on you. And you know, an eagle's eyes are about the same size as a person's eyes.
Yes.
But the difference is that. We're, you know, I'm not going to say how many kilograms I am or you are. But an eagle, you know, can be between 3 and 12 kilograms. So the fact that they have eyes the same size as ours. I heard somebody say that if we had the equivalent size eyes, it would be like two giant Christmas oranges on the size of our heads. That's the equivalent.
Well, their eyesight is amazing. It's something to do like 3 to 3.5 times that of what we see. So
yeah. Well, so like our eyeballs, we only have one fovea at the back of the eyeball, which is just this basically a pit or depression, which has photoreceptors in it. And it's where we get our 20/20 vision. It's where we get how we determine whether we have good colour insight or not. And depth of detail and things like that. Eagles have two. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they're twice as good. It just means that they're able to see things much further because they have different depths, different abilities. But they can't really move their eyes. So when you see them, often you'll see them kind of moving their head from side to side or staring directly. And if they're staring directly, they're looking at distance, how far something is. And again, they can see basically the same as us in terms of what they see. But
they're just seeing a further distance.
Exactly. So like if it would be like us in a room seeing a rabbit on the other side of the room, they'd be able to see it in exactly the same detail as us, but if that was 2 or 3 kilometres away. So they don't actually see something different, just
further.
Amazingly better.
Wow. That is, they're just great. I know what you mean. They have that presence, that aura of just power.
Yeah.
It just comes across
and
just sat there. And I think like there was something.
They're sturdy. They're so powerful.
Yeah. They're so powerful. They've got from their strong beaks. They're very heavy birds. I mean, the eagles are large birds of prey. That's really how you define them. But there's like I was reading the way they hunt is different to other birds of prey. So it's similar in the way that they'll never land when they hunt. So they grab and go. And everything is exactly the same as all other birds of prey, except one behaviour change where most other birds of prey will grab, fly and look behind them and see what else is around them. Eagles don't do that. They go, grab and just carry on. They don't turn. Mm. And it's a weird behaviour trait that's been seen in eagles, which when I read that, I was like, they just know they're the best. Like in the birds of prey, they're the top. They've got nothing to worry
about.
Yeah,
they're apex.
Oh, you mean the other ones look around to see if they're going to be attacked?
Yeah, well, other birds of prey, like maybe vultures or owls or something like that, might look to see if there's anything else. Like, I don't know if it's a danger thing or just to see direction, but eagles just don't do
it. Total vision, so focused.
Yeah, done, bam, and gone. But again, that might not be bulletproof among all species.
Yeah,
that might the smaller ones might do it occasionally, but nine times out of 10, they see that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So I felt that was really interesting. They just have that kind of, I don't know, I'm projecting here, but self-awareness of how cool they are.
Yeah.
Also, it's pretty amazing that so obviously there's quite a few fish eagles.
Yes.
And catching fish underwater, because obviously you have to make calculations.
Yeah.
To change
depth as well.
Yeah, because a fish won't actually be where you see it is. It's going to be in a slightly different position.
Yeah.
But that refractive error, it's a refractive error, isn't something that when a young eagle doesn't have that, they have to develop their eyes before, like when they're mature, to get that disparity corrected to be able to work out where a fish is.
Wow.
And so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The young fish eagles, they'll be getting ones that are either dead, floating up on the top, or are at the very surface.
Yeah, because it's also carrion. They also eat a lot of sea
exactly,
carrion as well,
yeah.
Yeah,
so. Yeah, and a lot of seagulls, they do also eat stuff that isn't fish.
Yeah. That's the thing, there's four groups of eagles, and they're all, well, two of them are very specific for what they eat.
Yeah.
One group. So you've got fish eagles, you've got booted eagles, harp eagles, then you've got snake eagles, which just sounds like the scariest animal I've ever.
Imagine a snake that could fly.
When I first read it, I was like, snake eagle. Like, but then that is such a human thing when we're naming animals, is to just put another animal's name before it.
Yeah, like the Philippine eagle used to be called the monkey-eating eagle.
Yeah, just because it did it once, or something like that. It's like the bird-eating spider. They saw it once,
exactly.
It's like, well, that's your name. It's like, judge it for the rest of its life.
But I love the booty eagle as well, and you mentioned there is that sense, there's an aura about them. And there was one particular, it was just the classic American bald-head eagle. Mm-hmm. Was just, my two boys went to point, wow. Look, wow, that's the symbol of America and all this kind of thing, the history behind it. And he looked at us for a minute and then just turned his back on us.
Yeah.
He went, wow, we were good enough for him. He was bored with us.
Yeah, I really respect animals like that.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, great.
That's what I mean. There's just a big thing about self-awareness. Whenever I see them, they're just like, I feel like they know what's going on.
Yeah.
They're just like, you can't mess
with
it. Yeah, you can't. Do you guys know how many species of eagle roughly there are?
72?
I've got to say
60 plus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's definitely 60 plus. Yeah, so I
think there's 60 plus 12 of another kind.
I
was fairly confident when I said 72, though.
No, I was reading a lot of different numbers. The one that kept coming up was just going like, oh, 60 plus. But I was reading a lot of like, oh, 68 or 70, 72. Yeah, so there's a lot of debate among some.
Like, I'm not saying I'm right, I'm just saying.
No, it's just that's the number I have. Most are found in Europe. Which all are found in Europe and Africa. Most are found in Europe and Africa. Only four are found, 14 outside of those areas, two in North America, nine in Central America, Central and South America, and then three in Australia. Yeah, so, and then they're separated into those four groups, which kind of just is the harpy eagles.
The harpy eagles are kind of a strange group.
Yeah,
because
basically,
the harpy eagle group, I think now, is kind of a jungle group more than
anything.
Yeah,
well, that's what they live in tropical forests. There's only about 2 to 6 species.
Because the thing about eagles, like what you were saying, basically the only definition for an eagle is that it's a very large bird of prey.
Yeah.
Like there is, some of the eagles are not particularly well, like, related to each other.
Yeah.
Like, it's just that they're very, very large and they have a big beak.
Yeah.
Like, that's essentially...
You're really describing a group of animals just on their parents, because even a harpy eagle is 2 to 6 species and they're not even way related.
No, exactly. So the harpy eagle group is basically just a harpy eagle and then other eagles that live in jungles.
In tropical, that are big,
and whether they're related or not. Like,
Because it's such a broad species as well, there's a really wide diet with a lot of them, I was reading.
Yeah.
So like I said, the snake eagle is called a snake eagle because it
was seen
eating a snake. And they eat a lot of reptiles, they do eat a lot of reptiles.
But a lot of eagles would eat reptiles
anyway.
Regardless.
Yeah,
like,
if
it's available.
I was going to say, I would describe them as opportunistic.
Mm.
Would you? I mean, they hunt, but they also like will just see what they can get.
Yeah, it depends. Like, I mean, yeah, like a harpy eagle, I think is 79% sloths. Which
really?
Yeah.
Oh wow!
Did you ever see that video on Facebook? It was doing the rounds there for a while, where an eagle swooped down and picked up a small child.
Really?
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me.
No, dropped the child because the child was a bit too heavy, but swooped down.
Was this like in a
toddler and went about 3-4 feet in the air and then the toddler dropped.
No, I do remember seeing that.
Was that
in America?
Yeah,
like, was it like a wild eagle or was it like an eagle in
a park?
No,
it was a wild. It was in a park. It was in a national park and it picked it up.
Because I was just saying, you were saying it's opportunist. You know,
you
see something small and moving, but it'll have that.
Yeah, I do. I've forgotten. And then you put that image back in my head.
So eagles, they generally don't, they can't carry something that is heavier than their own body weight.
Yes.
Now,
yeah.
They have been noted to kill things that are much larger than that. So, and carrion, as you were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So if they did really want that child, they would have killed the child and brought it.
And then brought
a leg and then brought a arm and whatnot.
Yeah.
So don't worry. So it's fine.
Well, yeah, because you say that, like, golden and crown eagles have been, they've killed ungulates, antelopes and stuff, weighing up to about 30 kilos. So
wow.
They kill, and like you said, they don't really themselves get above 12, 13?
Yeah, there was a harpy eagle called Jezebel who reached 12.5, but...
we're not fat-shaming Jezebel, just saying.
But Jezebel did live in a domestic setting, so you're kind of... Yeah, exactly. She was having a spice bag after a night out. Yeah. So I think like 10 kilos, 11 kilos is kind of your very top. And they are sexually dimorphic. Almost exclusively.
You're right, I was reading that a lot actually when I was looking at the weights and stuff, the females. Yeah. It was always listening to females' weight rather than...
And that's with a lot, like sometimes that can be to do, I know with a lot of hawks and falcons that's to do with, which aren't eagles, just in case anyone's writing in, that's sometimes to do with the nesting, that's when your nesting is generally during a lot more coverage.
Yeah.
So the males would be the ones that are hunting and they need to be smaller to get smaller prey.
I don't know
if that's the same, this is just speculation on my part. Well,
it also just seems to work. You get a fat stuff like that sometimes. It's not proven, but you're like, well, it makes sense.
And also, like, I mean, they're laying eggs. They're laying big eggs and having big babies, so, you know.
Yeah, and they're spending all that time with them. Going back to the hunting, there was... the bald eagle was noted for having flown away with the heaviest prey, and it was one individual caught a 6.8 kilos, so about 15-pound mule deer fawn, and flew away with it, which is heavy.
Yes.
That is like a lot of weight. Like, you would,
Wow.
I'd probably struggle to lift that.
Yeah. Especially fly with it.
And fly with it, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
You'd
be asked to put that in a hold. Like.
Yeah. I'm nearly having to check that in on Ryanair. Like. There's one thing I've not mentioned. Going off of the feeding, I think this is the scariest thing I've ever read. So, obviously, eagles build nests in trees and cliffs, usually lay two eggs at a time. The older and larger... young will frequently kill the younger sibling.
Yeah, which like isn't that uncommon with birds. Like birds generally lay more eggs than...
Wait, hang on. Sorry, just run that by me again.
So they'll lay two eggs. One, they'll both hatch. Usually one will hatch first.
Before, yeah.
And then that will usually be the dominant, stronger one, because it might get a bit of food before. And then when the other one hatches, it will just kill it and eat it, usually.
Yeah, and it's like... Wow. So for some species, like say for the harpy eagle... It will only ever be one chick, but they will lay usually two eggs. So with some species, it will just be only ever one. But like I think, say, golden eagles, they have been noted in really good years to manage to bring three.
Oh, really?
To fledging. But usually it could be two. Like they'd lay three and the third would routinely. And sometimes they would like last a week or two, but then the parents just know, like if it's not going to survive, they'll kill it and feed it to the...
If you thought you didn't get along with your siblings, me and my brother have had our spats, but he's never tried to kill me.
Like, smallest.
When I read that, I was just like, Jesus.
But it makes sense in terms of, like, I mean, it would just be calories. Like, we can't over-sensitize
That's us projecting on the kind of...
And he probably didn't even have a name at that stage.
Exactly, so,
There's no personal connection.
Cool. And each eagle, when you look at them, is kind of fitted to their environment as well. Like, so the sizes, like we were saying, a lot of sea eagles are built to kind of glide a lot more. Like, and you've got the forest eagles... the harpy eagles that are in the rainforest are built for that environment. They've got a shorter wingspan usually.
Which like, I mean, the harpy eagle has, I think, a maximum wingspan of 2.25 meters. So it's not like small, but for the length of it, it actually is quite
just
small.
It's pretty impressive.
Impressive.
But it makes sense when you're going through jungle, you don't want to be going clipping
So we got what I did is I went through, I was looking at all these charts of different eagles and stuff, so I thought I'd pick the heaviest, the longest, and then the longest wingspan. So the heaviest eagle is a Stella's sea eagle, which is considered vulnerable in the wild. Gets up to about 6.7 kgs, about 15 pounds.
It was the one you saw on Tater with the yellow beak.
Ah, that guy.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, that beak.
Yeah, it's like his beak is very distinctive.
Yeah,
because
like
it seems to go back much further.
Majority of his face.
Yeah,
is
exactly. It is distinctive, as he said.
He was very judgmental as well.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, yes. Because the beak takes up so much of his face, I think it makes his eyes look smaller. Yeah. So it's very, squinting at you.
I would say that I think, like, if I was critically endangered, I probably also would be very judgmental.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think I think he's okay. I'd give it to him. I'll let him have it.
Yeah, let him have that. The longest eagle body weight is a Philippine eagle, so it's 100 centimetres.
Used to be the monkey eating.
Used to be the monkey, which is 3.3 foot, and it also has the longest wingspan, which just makes sense, which is 220 centimetres, so about 7.3 foot.
That's average.
Yeah, average. Which is huge.
Huge, bigger
than me.
Yeah, but like, so Ireland reintroduced back in 2007, and lots of places in Scotland as well, the white-tipped eagle.
Oh, really?
Which has been known to go up to 2.45, like... So, I mean, the average is something along the line of 222.
It's very good.
Which is pretty massive. And it's quite, this year is a big year for the white-tipped eagle in Ireland, because we introduced them in 2007 with 15, I think, and then over the next couple of years, they brought in 100 from Norway.
Oh, wow.
Last year...
More Vikings.
Exactly. with talons. So last year there were 10 confirmed breeding pairs and 21, I think, fledglings were recorded and ringed. But this year, because it will be the first year that ones that had fledged in Ireland could be sexually mature and having their own nest. So it will be a really big milestone.
Yeah, that's great. Where have they released them? Whereabouts in Ireland?
I think Connemara. I think west. So, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I didn't know that had happened. That's great. Yeah. Reintroduction of species. I love it. Right, so what we're going to do is we're going to play our top trump part for eagles. So we're going to judge them, and we're going to rate them one from 10 in appearance, interesting factor, and then boss level. So, Eric, for appearance for eagles in general, or you can pick a specific, but in general, out of 10?
Well, I would say, I'm going to give them an 8.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good. And yourself?
Because of their beaks and their talons, I feel like if I give them anything under 8, they'll come after me.
Especially now you just reintroduced them to Ireland.
Exactly. Like,
and they're on a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, because I really like the harpy eagle. I like the way it's got like a bit of a plate face.
Yeah.
I like the way the Stellar's sea eagle has that big yellow one. So I just go give it a 9.
You're gonna go 9. Solid. Yeah, nice. Yeah. Interesting factor. I went with 7, because they're great, but again,
they're kind of like, we know them.
But yeah, you don't
know.
It's
not their fault. It's the fact is, it's too much. They suffer from big name recognition, I think.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I hear to say
there's been a lot of research into it. We've kind of got the information. So that was more my point. That's why I went with 7. What would you go with, Eric?
Yeah, I'm blown away by the fact that the if there's two eggs, the first one will eat the one that hasn't hatched. I like that. I mean, I don't like it. I'm impressed by that. So that's piqued my interest more in eagles, so I'm going to give it an 8.
Sweet. And yourself, Ruth?
Do you know what? Like, I love eagles. I gave them a 9 for... Did I give them a 9 for
You gave
appearance?
Them a 9 for appearance.
Giving them a
6. Cool. Yeah. No, I get you with that. I do get you.
Sorry about that. Sorry, eagles.
And boss level. Now, boss level can be strength, can be what they can put up with. I'm going to go 9.
I have to say.
It could be anything else, really. I mean,
10. It could be something else.
They're not a shark. Sorry, 9.
Because if you look at the avian world, they're apex predator.
Yeah.
Eagles. So it's just they're the biggest of the best. So I was like, 9. Always room for improvement, guys.
Maybe if you've actually taken off of that child. That's
exactly. And also, harpy eagles have sometimes solitary ones, and young ones have been taken by jaguars.
So maybe learn
how to deal with that, maybe. Yeah. And then maybe we'll give you a 10. This is
on the last episode, comedian Rich Wilson, after we were just on our last animal, he said, it's great, isn't it? There's thousands and millions of years of evolution. These animals have changed, they've adapted, and we're here going 4. I'll give him a 4. And it does, now he said that, every time I'm doing this bit I'm like, yeah, it is a bit bad. It's fine. Cool, so they've got an overall score of 74, which is strong, which is very strong.
It's not bad.
So now we're going to move on to our next animal, which is eels. Now, we made a point of saying this before we pressed record.
I'm going to clarify this
straight away, because there's going to be people listening and going, cool, I love electric eels. Guys, I'm sorry to say that eel is also used for some other eel-shaped fish, such as electric eels, spiny eels. Yeah. They're not. They evolved that shape completely differently in the separate, so they're not related. So we're not... I'm going to let you have one fact.
No, you can have one fact. Well, okay, my fact is going to be that they're obligate air breathers, which means they get 80% of the air from the surface. So, like, cool.
Yeah, because you see them come up to the surface quite regularly. Yeah, you see that. Okay, cool. There's your fact.
There you go. There's your fact.
Wow.
That's
not like normal fish. They actually need air.
Yeah. They'll come up and obstruct the oxygen from
that's,
there.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
My interest has peaked already.
Except it's not an eel, so now we have to move on.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Right.
It's just eel shaped.
Right.
I also know the three electric organs, electric eel.
Go on, I'll let you.
The main abdominal, the sacs, and the hunters.
There you go. Right. Ruth, guys, if you can't see this, but it's just like got all this electric eel information she really wants to share. But
no, that was my only information. Really. It's also because, like, you know, I read a paper and it was like it works very much like a battery, like they're electric pulses. And I was like, I don't know how a battery works. So then I had to learn about how a battery works. And but anyway, it's fine. I mean, maybe when you're doing electric eel sometime, you can get me on.
We will.
I don't know. We'll do a bonus
electric eel
episode. Yeah, sure. Amazing.
How do you guys feel about eels? Because they are one of those animals they're like the snake, I guess, just from a shape point of view. They're always, people just get a bit weird around them.
No, it's not that. Yeah. I just don't trust them.
Oh, I just don't
trust an eel. So, like, you know, if I was in a sea cave and one entrance had a 5-foot eel, another had a 5-foot shark, I would every time go to the one that had a 5-foot
shark.
That's
a good scenario.
Because, like, I would.
You see, I don't really know much about eels, but I know where you're coming from. I would freak out if I was in the water and an eel just suddenly started running around my legs. I would freak me out completely.
Because I feel like a shark, like you could talk to a shark and just be like, sorry, I actually need to get out. And the shark would be like, fine, yeah, that's a reasonable request. Whereas if you go to the eel, I feel like the eel will just like eat your face off just because it could.
You watched A Little Mermaid recently, have you?
No, is that but that's those are electric eels.
Are they? Oh, how do I bring it up? God.
So, I don't know.
See what I mean? Everything to do with it, we were going to go back
no,
to
No, I mean, I think they were an amalgamation of sea eels and electric eels. Because they had electric powers, but they lived in the ocean.
So eels have teeth, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, eels have teeth.
Well, we'll be going into that, I think. But
they
at certain stages,
I look
they do.
Forward to it. Carry on.
Well, no, okay, so, you look like you want to say something.
No, you go for it,
Eels are pretty incredible, even if I don't trust them. And, like, I give them that respect. I respect them, I don't trust them. But the European eel in particular, people have been just really confused by them for literally millennia. Mm-hmm. So Aristotle was the first person to be recorded to write about them, talking about how, because nobody had ever seen a juvenile or a sexually mature eel. So they'd seen the eels that you see.
Yeah.
Well, not me personally, but the eels one sees.
Yeah.
But they'd never seen these kind of baby eels, and they'd never seen eels mate. So there was this kind of idea that maybe they just sprung out of the ground. And in fact, Aristotle thought perhaps maybe they were earthworms who went into the ocean.
Oh, interesting theory. Yeah.
And then I was saying to Ryan earlier that Sigmund Freud also dissected one when he was in college and couldn't find the sexual organs and had a big pissy fish. Like, there was just he couldn't. It's like, why don't they have gonads? Why?
Yeah.
And it's because they have a very complex life system. They start off as leptocephalus. They have a leptocephalus larval stage. Thank you for the mass. Leptocephalus larval stage.
That sounds like an STD.
Yeah.
That's why they can't breed. That's why they're endangered.
Basically, it's this larva that's flat. It doesn't really look that much like an eel. It kind of
looks
like a fluke, maybe, like that kind of like that.
Very
kind of,
flat.
But absolutely see through. And then eventually it becomes a glass eel, which used to be thought of as a separate species. Like, again, we're only really talking about relatively recently, 100 or 200 years ago, people did sort of think that maybe eels just appeared. And then they start metamorphosing, so a bit like, not as dramatic, but a bit like a butterfly and a caterpillar.
Mm. So how long does this transition take?
So for going to the, depends on the species, this is European eels, it will go from the leptocephalus. Yeah.
There's so many when I was reading all
the stuff. It goes from being the weird stuff to being looking more like an eel kind of around, I think, about 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not long.
Okay. Yeah. And like, I mean, when they're at that early stage, they're in, you know, these swarms of several million, but they're tiny. Like, you're talking about just a few millimeters.
Yes. Yeah.
When they then go to the glass eel stage, they can go up to about 90 millimeters. Again, this is just European eels. Other eels are different. Then they start changing colors and they start changing, like, their actual bodies because they're going from salt water to fresh water. So they have to change their gills. They have to change. They have to grow new organs. And then they go into estuaries and then they start becoming elvers.
Yeah, that was my favourite bit. When I was reading about like, elvers just sounds like someone's got the word eel and they're just adapting it to the different stages of their life.
Yeah.
Like pig, piglin, eel.
Elver. And elvers are starting beginning to be kind of where people recognise eels. You're from London. They eat eels.
They eat elvers. That's the reason why the European eel.
So that'd be a glass eel then, not an elver maybe.
No, I think it would be an elver because they're big. The chunks it's like almost like I'm trying to think of a food to compare it to. Like almost as thick as like cucumber.
Water.
Like
wow.
Yeah. I mean, not just a cucumber laid out flat, chopped up.
Yeah.
But you sometimes have a bone still in the middle. So it must be like elvers. Yeah.
So then they become yellow. And then they swim up. And then when they're about 10 or 15, they decide, hey, let's have sex. And then their bodies change again. And again, they completely change. They have to go back into salt water. They have to grow sexual organs.
This is all mind-blowing to me now. And never knew this existed.
I know.
Eels. I just assumed eels were like fish. They were tiny eels. They grew into big eels. Yeah. But this metamorphosis.
Yeah.
When you see the diagram of it and you go, even a basic diagram, you're like, wait, what? Okay, but you're following it around going, so this is and this is also fresh water, and this is salt water, and this is like such a complex life system for such a, when you look at an animal that we think, it's just an eel.
And we still just know so little about it. We know a lot about European eels, but really only comparatively compared to other eels. Like, we actually don't know that much about European eels, and it's a big problem in terms of conservation because we don't really know how you conserve them because we're not really sure what's happening.
You don't know what's happening, you don't know. So, I mean, especially, which we'll go on to in a minute, but the breeding, there's been numerous attempts throughout Europe to try and recreate the breeding life cycle for them. It's so hard and they can't even get, you're saying this process can take a couple of years, that they're struggling to get the larvae to survive more than 10 days.
Wow.
So it's real. They're in a bit of trouble, the European eel.
But just going to the point about the teeth. So a conger eel is the European conger would be the largest.
Yes.
And they can grow up, I think, to 9 feet.
No more. Sometimes. I think up to about 12.
Okay. Big.
Big. Yeah.
They can be big.
Well, they're the heaviest. So the max size is 3 meters.
Yeah.
And the max weight is about 110 kilos.
So they live their entire lives in salt water, so they don't have the same life cycle, but they have a very similar one. But when they reach the point where they're going to start breeding, all their teeth fall out, and their digestive system...
How attractive! How do they get to mate?
Yeah. Which is why they're in danger. They get
their digestive system disappears, it dissolves. A bit like quite a lot of insects when they become breeding. So they can no longer eat, they have to. So all their teeth fall out, their bone structure starts getting much thinner, digestive system disappears and they swim off to tropical climes and lay 3 to 8 million eggs. And that's
crazy.
It. Then they die because they got no digestive system.
They got no,
If ever any member of the animal kingdom deserved its own soap,
it's
so much drama.
Sorry, podcast
Wait, write that down. Yeah, definitely. They range in size as well. Like, so they're described as elongated fish, from the one-jawed eel, which is tiny, which is 5 centimeters long, to the slender giant moray eel. Again, I reckon it's quite slender. Guess it's about 13
I think it's not as slender as you think.
No, it's probably not.
It's
13 foot
fairly,
long.
It's probably I think it's fairly sturdy.
And they lack, you can tell an eel really, because they lack their pelvic fins. They lack pelvic fins, and many species also lack their pectoral fins. The dorsal and anal fins are fused together with the caudal fin to form one single ribbon the majority way down of their body. So that's how, and they move by waving, putting waves through their body, which they can actually reverse and go backwards as well. So there's a lot of the morays kind of live in they call them family groups. I don't know if they are. They're not family groups, but they live in like kind of rock works, and they all live in a big group, which I've got the word written down somewhere.
It's an eel pit, isn't it?
That was it, eel pit. Yeah, they describe it as an eel pit, which is up there with the scariest of all the pits, I think. You've got snake pit, eel pit, bear pit. I think those three. Yeah.
Bear pit is lovely.
But, oh God, not in a comedy club. Sorry, that bad audience is described as bear pits.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, it's...
And the mosh pit.
The mosh pit. But some species live in really deep water as well, on continental shelves, about 4,000 metres down.
Yeah.
Which is really far.
Do you know what I think it is? Because we were talking again. You probably forgot. We were talking about glass snakes, which aren't snakes. They're lizards with
no legs.
With no legs, but it's kind of a strange one because it has a shape kind of like a snake, but has a much broader head.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the thing with the eels that I don't like is that like their heads are quite scary.
Their jaw is so obvious.
Yeah.
As well. I think their mouth is always nearly open.
Yeah.
They're just kind of always.
And to kind of go, wah, 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 yeah. Which I know doesn't really translate on podcasts, but I'm.
Yeah. The closest encounter I've had with an eel, I did work with someone in an aquarium, I worked with conger eels, which was amazing. But then I was snorkeling, I think it was in Mexico somewhere, and there was a freshwater eel, but I went down. So when I got into the water, I went down a ladder like that. And then I kind of pushed myself away, but I was only about 2 foot away from the ladder. And as I kind of looked up, in the grooves of the ladder was an eel just looking at me. And I was like, and this was like, I had only been in the water 10 seconds. And I was like, well, I want to get out. Like, this is terrifying.
And their eyes are quite forward facing, aren't they?
Really forward facing, quite bright a lot of the time as well in some species. So it's just like,
wow. And,
yeah.
Like, seriously, I'm going to look up eels after this.
They're an amazing animal. They really are.
Just don't trust them.
Just don't trust them. Don't, never let them look after your phone.
No.
There'll be pictures on the cloud all over the place. So we're talking a lot about the European eel, which is critically endangered. Since the 70s, numbers have dropped by 90%. There's been several breeding attempts. So there was some places in the Netherlands that were trying to recreate or simulate the kind of the journey that they have to go on sometimes, which is actually just pushing water. But all they have to do is recreate about a 6,500 kilometre journey. So they're having to pump this water to get the eels to do that, which clicks in this breeding cycle.
Which makes sense that, like, I mean, if you have to go through a metamorphosis, like, you have to go through very specific things. I mean, they were evolved for millennia to be like this. So you can't just
put them to get male, female together.
Yeah.
Go. It's like, no, you have to recreate the whole journey, which, but few places have succeeded to actually get the larvae. So I think the longest it said has survived 20 to 22 days and then the larvae's gone. And that's recent, that was in about 2012. So, yeah, that's the difficult thing with the European eel is the breeding. They're struggling to do it, so they're not sure what to do. Obviously, fishing methods changing would be absolutely wonderful if they could just stop for a bit.
But it's like, is it purely to do with destruction at the larval stage, or is it also to do with river quality for
The wild or
in the wild mean, no in yeah, the wild yeah. like in terms of the numbers and the
there's loads so there's a lot of parasite reasons as well and it is a lot of destruction or interruption in habitat so it's the more boats going through and stuff just kind of especially like you were saying with an animal that's so this is the way we do it and evolved to do it but if you're interrupting that it's the same as sea turtles if you interrupt something it's completely screwed but we're going to do our top trump eel bit now. So, Eric's face just looks like, I'm not sure how I feel.
Are eels your new favourite animal?
It's the most fascinating.
This is, doing the appearance of an eel is interesting because usually whenever we say appearance of an animal, we think whether it's cute or we like it. Whereas eels, I love them, but I can see why people would want to rate them low down. But I've given them a 7 because of the way they look a bit creepy and...
I'm giving them a 3.
Are you going to give them a 3? No, it's fine.
Well, I did like the one I saw on the beach, even if he was dead. But no, I'm giving him a 3.
A 3?
I probably would have been onto this conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go 6.
6. Cool. Okay. No, and interesting factor.
10.
I'll
go for 10.
I went 9.
Yeah, I go for 9 as well. Not quite 10, but 9.
Just what do you need for a 10? Yeah. Gosh.
Which but I know what you mean. I need a bit more. The metamorphosis is great. They just need to. I don't know.
I don't think they have any. Like the thing is,
I've got nothing else to give.
Yeah, exactly. I think they've really thrown everything at their interestingness. Like I don't think they can do anymore. But anyway, I'll give them a 10.
You're an 8. Yeah.
Show you're talking ill. You got your ten.
boss level was an interesting one because I didn't really know what to judge
boss,
that on.
Yeah, and you know, like at its larval stage, it's not particularly boss.
No, God.
However, it does go around in a giant, you know, kind of swarm. So I mean, it at least takes that into account.
I gave 5 because also we didn't really talk much about their hunting or their eating.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask that question, and now I'm asking it before what do they eat, and what will they survive on?
It's obviously species dependent on where they are. Obviously, small fish, crustaceans,
plankton, in
their early stage of life. Sea snow, when they're larvae, they'll eat a lot of that, which is kind of just like detritus on top of the water. From that point of view, it's very varied. But if you're talking about the adult size and from a hunting point of view,
I think it could eat a small child. I mean, not based on any fact.
That was just an opinion, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Well, that's not science.
Congrioles, when they're fully grown, they are huge and they've got a very big mouth. And they're opportunistic as well because they're in the rocks a lot of the time, so they just kind of like pounce out. Mm.
I'm going to go 6.
I feel that's fair. Yeah, 6 is fair.
And you're going to go 6 as well?
Yeah, just because if we were to look at just one life cycle, maybe I'd go higher, but we're looking at
it's
four
very
life cycles. Complex.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And also, like, at one stage of the life cycle, it doesn't have a digestive system. So, I mean, like, four teeth. It has no teeth or digestive system. So, like, six is fair.
Cool. Well, that gives the eel score of 61. So, at the moment, we've got the eagles in the lead. But now we're going to move on to our next animal, which is, I've got a feeling we're all just going to love this animal on here, which is the elephant. It's similar to the giraffe.
Yeah.
Distinctive looking, know what it is.
And just the baby ones.
They're so cute.
They are one of those animals where you go, have you got a baby? The adults are great, but if you can bring a young one.
I know I'm the designated animal expert, so I shouldn't be, you know.
No, that, I mean.
Being too compassionate. We saw the baby one.
At Dublin Zoo.
And it was just, I was just saying to Ryan, but because its trunk is so distinctive, but at a baby stage, it's kind of like a triangular trunk.
Yeah, and it still doesn't know what it's doing with it yet.
Exactly.
This is
and he's tripping over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely beautiful.
So, talking about elephants, there's 3 species. You've got the African bush elephant, and you've got the African forest elephant, which are both listed as vulnerable, which is changing. And then you've got the Asian elephant, which is endangered. Mm. Now, they're the largest land animal. The average African male gets to 3.2 metres, so about 10 foot, and weighs 6,000 kilos.
Yeah. Whoa!
I know. I read that, and then I had to read that again to make sure I could still read numbers. I was like, I did read that, 6,000 kilos.
It's pretty big.
It's huge. I mean, the African forest is a lot smaller. Only gets about 2 meters, mm-hmm. which I am taller than that. So when I read that, I was like, oh man, I'm taller than an elephant. And only gets, well, I say only, 2,000 kilos, which is still very large, but not in comparison to the African bush elephant. And then the average Asian elephant male gets to about 2.75, so about 9 foot and 4,000 kilos. So there's a bit of a range there.
Yeah.
A bit of a range. Their features, let's talk about their top features. So we've already said the trunk.
Yeah, that's kind of a feature.
It's kind of a feature. They're known for it. They are known for it.
The tusks, the ears.
Literally, you've just read my list right there.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's great. No, those are the feet. And their feet.
But the thing about the elephant is like every single aspect of it, and I know you can say this about any animal, but every single aspect is just so perfectly adapted.
Yes.
For being an elephant.
Yeah, yeah. It's why they are especially their ears. We're going to talk about that in a minute.
And
but they
feet.
Are.
I'm a big.
Yeah, you're a big
feet.
Fan of their feet.
I'm a big
you?
Fan of their feet.
Their ears contain numerous capillaries, which kind of transfer warm blood through, which regulates their body. It kind of gets rid of excess heat.
Yeah.
And by flapping those ears, it speeds up that process.
Wow.
So they can regulate, which is why the African bush elephant has the largest ears out of all of them. This is where you say that they're adapted. So mm-hmm. Forest elephants and Asian elephants are going to have a lot shorter ears because they're not in as warm climate or they've got more shade and stuff. But their trunk as well contains up to 150,000 separate Oh, I'm going to mispronounce this word. I'm so dyslexic sometimes.
Fascicles?
Fascicles, there you go.
Which
contain no bone and very little fat, but they can lift up to about 350 kilos with it.
Yeah, that's the thing about trunks, is that they do so much. You know, it's obviously it's essentially their hand, but it's also a social tool.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that they use to socialise and to bond, and then it also is a really good actual nose.
Yeah.
It's 4.5 times, I think, better than the strongest scent hound.
Yes, so
it's which you wouldn't necessarily assume with an elephant, for even though it has a giant nose, that would necessarily be a brilliant
or
sniffer.
It would need it,
but it
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
And obviously, it also uses it for vocalization,
and for breathing, just in general.
Yeah.
Like they can go through water and they can use it as a
snorkel.
They can take up,
they can lift small people up onto their back.
They can,
I've seen that a lot. The Asian elephant can hold 8.5 litres of water in its trunk at one time, which is like, that's what we have to be drinking in a day. Like,
not all at once and not from an elephant.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
also, sorry, the prior two animals you spoke about, the eagles and the eels, is there like both great bands as well?
Yeah.
Is there a band called the Elephants?
There's not. But do you know what you said? Yeah, that's funny, because when I was first doing a bit of research about the animals, putting eagles, band.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Putting eels, band. I was like, for God's sake, I had to put eel animal. This is the internet for you. You can't even put a natural thing in without it going, do you mean the band? It's like, no, the eel band. No, of course I don't. 2018, for God's sake. Their teeth are really cool. So you were saying about their tusks are actually their incisors, so their teeth that just grow forward. So they lose their milk teeth, I think, about 6 months, and then they start growing their tusks. They grow 17 centimetres, so they constantly grow 17 centimetres a year.
Yeah,
the tusks constantly grow.
The tusks grow?
Yeah, constantly.
But what's that, African elephants? Because obviously there's some Asian elephants that even the males don't grow tusks.
Yeah, some don't have them. Yeah. The ones that have the tusks, so African elephants, both males and females have them, they can reach up to 3 metres, which is 10 foot. Only males have them in Asian elephants, and sometimes not even then.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is dependent.
What I do like about tusks as well is that elephants have a dominant tusk, so they're either right or left.
Yes,
tusks.
I read this. Because it said, when I was reading it, they went, like humans, they're left and right. And I was like, what, wing? Politically? What are they were really so sure. Where's this going? Had no idea it was going to say that. And then it was like, they're left and right tusks. And I was like, that's incredible. So one of them will be slightly curved and low. And I was like, that is awesome. Why? Like, that's my next question. I was like, why are they left and right?
Because all animals, essentially, do have a left or right preference. And
that's great. I loved it when I read that.
And they give it as much thought as us picking up something with our left or right hand.
That's the other thing with the tusks. They're used for a lot of things, from a weapon, for a start, for males. Mm-hmm. Also, digging and,
getting bark away.
To get to food.
I've always known about the tusk, but I just thought it was more of a decoration thing. They actually use it.
So dig in to get to maybe water or mud to cool down, and now especially use it during fighting, which is when you see it happen, it's very terrifying. So they live in, their society is known as a fission fusion, meaning that it's multiple family groups that kind of come together, but the family groups are female, so the cows with their offspring, and then other females with their offspring, led by the oldest female, so it's matriarchal. Males usually live solitary or live in a few groups with young males, and they only interact with family groups when looking for a mate. They get increased testosterone around that time, and it's called must. They kind of a very one-tracked mind, shall we say.
By 60. Multiplies by 60 times the testosterone rate.
Yes.
Like elephants, when they're not in lust, are still kind of like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to keep away.
I was actually when I was thinking about it today, I've been quite close to a male elephant before, and I was just
really?
But at the time, it didn't really occur to me, but it was only just when I was looking up again and the must, and I was like, probably shouldn't have been that close.
Yeah.
In hindsight.
Probably shouldn't have done that. Their teeth are quite cool as well. Going back, so we were talking about their tusks, but their teeth, unlike mammals, they have...
Yeah,
so unlike most mammals, sorry. they have baby teeth... But we replace our baby teeth with one set of adult teeth, which is usually what happens in most mammals. However, elephants don't. They replace their teeth up to 6 times, and they don't. They're not replaced by like ours. They come underneath, and ours fall out and something. Theirs go from the back and push forward, which is kind of cool. And like I said, yeah, that happens.
That happens to rodents, doesn't it?
Yes, it happens in it happens in rodents as well. And it's for elephants, it happens the first time. So obviously, about six months is when they lose their milk teeth, and then it happens about 2 years old, their first set of teeth will go. Then it happens again about 3 to 6 years old, then again at 12. So it seems to be that kind of quite basic. They live up to about 70 years, some of them as well. So quite a long lifespan. Conservation, I think, is something we have to talk about with elephants. We haven't spoken about it really with the other species, but they're in a bit of trouble. Don't know if you guys knew that.
Well, I told you before, I used to work in a mammoth museum.
Yes, you did. Yeah. They're the what's the group?
A really big mammoth museum.
Yeah. Nothing to do with animals. It's a huge museum.
But one of the things was that it was a mammoth gallery, I think it was called. But one of its things was that it sold mammoth ivory, which doesn't need a permit.
Wow.
Because
they're gone.
They can't get. So yeah, and you get a lot of Russian oligarchs coming in who want a USB stick. Made out of ivory, but ethical mammoth ivory, and set about 10,000.
Really?
Yeah, for a USB stick.
For a USB.
You want your mammoth ivory USB stick, not a free one you get.
No.
From AIB.
Not there's anything wrong with AIB or any other bank.
Or any other bank.
So the African elephants are listed as vulnerable, but this shocked me when I read this because I didn't know the numbers and how much they had changed. 1979, there was roughly, for a start, what I will say, it's very hard to get specific numbers of elephants because of their wide range, and also politically what's going on in the areas, you can't just go in and count
and
elephants.
And also just, it's very regionalised.
Yes,
You're saying about the Asian elephants, in some parts, some of the Sumatra ones, there's very few of them. But because it's considered one species and there's a lot of domestication.
Yeah. So, in 1979, roughly, this is quite a large number gap, but 1.3 to 3 million elephants, which is a really healthy number. 1989, 10 years later, that number was down to 600,000. So a huge drop in numbers. And like I said, they differ from area to area, and it's very difficult to get the kind of numbers accurately. 2012, IUCN, which is the International Union of Conservation and Nature, listed a rough number of about 440,000 African elephants left. So that's still gone down since. Kind of going up sometimes. It's real. Again, like I said, I'm going to say this loads. It's hard to tell, but it's going up gradually.
It looks like they stopped the decline anyway.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, we've gone a long time later and it's still gone down, but it's not gone down as much. I mean, I think they lost nearly about 60% of their elephants in that
sometimes
time.
Sometimes I'm a bit cautious of those numbers, especially from South Africa.
Yes.
Because there are a lot, say, for example, lions are no longer endangered, whatever.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of national parks that aren't national parks in South Africa where they use hunting as conservation.
Yeah.
So they will have a lot of lions, and you can go in and you can shoot one, and the money goes back to conserving the animals. And a little bit like that, there's a few
with the
a few elephant areas where in Zimbabwe and South Africa you can.
This is what I mean. You are you taking that point? Are you counting?
They are a real population, and they are important for genetic diversity. As long as that genetic group can actually mate with other elephants elsewhere. But I'm sometimes cautious of. There's countries now that want to lift the endangered title off them, and it seems to be to do with hunting tourism.
By lifting that. That will reduce the hunting.
No. So that they're saying they're no longer endangered. We should be allowed to sell 2,000 permits.
Okay.
And that does seem to be happening in a couple of countries. And I mean, let's take it at face value. The numbers probably are going up, but it doesn't mean beaches are shutting them.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the beach. Beautiful elephant.
I know.
People argue, if it's going to the local people and it's going to conservation, I think that's all bullshit.
I agree.
The local people are not the ones getting the money.
No, they're not. I completely agree. I think it's a crazy idea to say the best way to save an animal is to kill it. It's to shoot an animal.
I just think the elephant will appeal to a lot of really bad shooters because how could you miss an elephant?
Exactly. Yeah.
Just people running around with guns like that, hoping they hit one.
The only thing is about that though, which is good, is that a lot of hunters do get killed for them.
Oh, so brilliant. Excellent.
So the hunting numbers have gone down as well. So it's they're now endangered. The Asian elephants are listed as endangered. There's only about 40 to 50,000 numbers left. They once ranged loads, Syria to Iraq to China.
Yeah.
But now the most of the population, likely half the population is in India now. But they've had about a 50% decline in about 60 to 70 years as well. And I get really upset when I was really enjoying doing my research up until the conservation bit. And I was just like, oh, for God's sake, so much bad shit happens to animals, big fauna like elephants, because people want the biggest and the best one. And there's actually been dwarfism happen in elephants over the years, where people have hunted the biggest and the best.
Yeah,
you've taken those genes out of the reproductive cycle.
So one of the things about education actually making an effect is that when I was living in Central Africa, I was quite interested in Chinese relations in Africa, and a lot of people who bought ivory as a status good, this is Chinese research done in China, didn't realise that an elephant had to be killed to get
really
ivory. So they bought the goods and they knew it came from an elephant, but they didn't necessarily, like, the vast majority of
consumers. Oh, they thought it was like toenail clippings.
Exactly. Like that, they took the, like, you know, they took the tusks and then the elephant, you know, ran off or whatever. So there does seem to be, and it's not that perceptible now, but there is like a decline in ivory demand in China, which was the main.
That's what it is. It's education all the time,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It always is. Like, you have to.
And there is a slightly like this kind of idea that's kind of based in quite bad racism that, you know, Chinese people just like to kill animals.
Yeah.
But it really is just this educational thing, which a lot of young Chinese people now are taking an interest in.
Yeah.
And they are being actively involved in conservation and actively involved in teaching people that.
Oh yeah, 100%.
So I think that market, which is this huge market, is going to show a decline. And
yes, yeah.
Some animals, hopefully it isn't too late, like pangolins.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not too late for elephants either.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic with elephants quite a lot. Although it upsets me when I see the numbers, I'm like, it's still a healthy-ish. You've got enough genetics out there to manage it.
And they're so big that I think people kind of latch onto them.
You can also keep an eye on them because they're so big.
Do
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not. Do you know? Like, there's some animals you're like, we haven't seen them for about 15 years.
Yeah.
Like, there are genuinely some, so they might be gone. The elephant is like, you're going to know when they're gone.
Yeah.
Like,
you're going to
know when you're in trouble. So I think they'll be all right. But yeah, so what we're going to do is do our final rating of elephants. So much
love for the elephant.
Yes, appearance.
Look, as you said, it's the largest. What is it, the largest?
Largest land mammal.
Yeah, look, right there, 10.
Yeah,
I'd give an African bush elephant a 10. An African forest elephant a 9, and I'd give an Asian elephant an 8, so we'll go for 9.
We'll go for 9. gradually goes down. Interesting factor. Eric?
To be honest with you, the elephant would be one of the animals that I suppose most people would have a bit of knowledge about.
We were saying
we didn't talk about the feet, but yeah.
We can. Let's go back to the feet. Like, okay, so I've put my score in. Let's hold it there.
Well, no, it's just that, I mean, this isn't unique to elephants, but they do walk on their tippy toes.
Yes.
And then they have this very thick cushion of complex tissues, which allows them to be so big, because it's said up to 6,000 kilograms. So when you see them walking, you do see their feet, because they're very, very circular feet.
Yes.
That then when they walk down, you can see that it's squashing down. Their foot actually squashes and spreads out. That's because they're putting all their
weight. So it's like a shock absorber.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So when they go down, you know, it expands. And, you know, it's quite amazing.
That is amazing.
But also, there is some theorizing. I haven't been able to find that much stuff, because they, we haven't talked much about the communication, but they can, they have infrasonic, is that what you're looking for?
Yes. We'll go for infrasonic.
Infrasonic communication over 20 kilometers.
Oh, wow.
And it does seem that possibly they are able to give communications either through stamping their feet and also through processing the shocks through their feet up into their inner ear.
That's just completely changed. I've just taken my number off because I didn't know that. As you were saying that, I took my number off and I'm going to put a different number in.
This was a hyperbole, but they said if it was raining 200 kilometers away, they could be able to pick up the rain.
Far away?
They said 200 kilometers. I read the quote and felt it was hope.
That's very far.
Yeah. And that was a bit like the rains down in Africa. Like, do you know, it was...
Wow, okay. Well, that's changed my number.
Go on.
I'm not going to say because I don't want to sway you guys.
I'm just going to go 8.
Okay.
I went with 8.
I'll go with 7.
7,
yeah.
Cool.
I'm interested in them, but like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're obsessed cool. with them. I'm obsessed with baby ones.
Yeah. It's the way they walk.
Yeah.
You see a baby elephant, they almost trot, yeah. And it's just this.
Like,
oh.
If you were talking about, you know, just ability, that'd be 12.
They look like the baby elephants have this look where they've. It's like, right, you're a baby, but we're giving you your full set of ears mm-hmm. now. You've got your full trunk now,
yeah.
And they're just like, whoa. Well, you grow into it, Steve. So yeah, you're fine. Right. So boss level. Now I'm marking my score based on strength.
Yeah, and I.
And
like I'm thinking of like the ones that I've met could definitely have killed me or all of them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
They're so large. There's not much you can do. But
yes.
One's running at you. So.
Except sidestep.
It would have to be a big sidestep.
Yeah, yeah. And like that's the thing about the forest ones is because often, you know, they're just kind of walk into one.
Yeah, that's true. They hide well in the forests as well. They really do. They're very quiet.
Happy.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. I'm going to say 9 because
cool.
A baby elephant would be nice to me.
I would have been 8 until I heard with the tusks because I just thought they were decorative. And now that they use it to fight and to dig... it's gone to a 9.
Yeah.
9, cool. Yeah. I went with 10, and I rarely give a 10, but I was like, I'm sorry. They just, I mean, although there are some predators that will take young ones, they're just, and the way they stand up as a group together as well, that's what I think I'm judging that on as well. Like, if.
Prize lions have been known to, at Salt Cliffs, I think, take.
They have it's real.
I mean, we're not going to take too many points off for that. I mean,
it's a real.
Take me much easier. It's
a real desperate times where lions will start taking a juvenile / adult elephant. But usually rarely they go for the young ones because you know all the females will just circle around them. And this is what I mean. It's like this big army, and it's just. Yeah, that's why I think I gave them a 10, which does mean that they get a score of 80, which means on this episode, elephants take the crown. They win. But yeah, guys, I just want to, first of all, thank you so much for coming on. Eric, thank you for being here. And I feel like you're going away now and just going to be thinking about eels for the rest of the day.
Eels, I'm going to check out elephants fighting.
Oh my god! Get in touch with Eric tonight. He's not all right. He's watched some stuff. He's not happy.
This is going to be really worrying if, like, in 10 years' time, we discover he's like has an underground elephant fish.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's taken to a new level.
Yeah, it's going to be like The Greatest Showman now, but in a very different film. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for all your knowledge. I really do appreciate it. You had a lot of great facts, a lot of great facts about the electric eel as well, which I did let you share. But thank you so much for coming down. Guys, thanks for being on the show. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll speak to you on another episode. Cheers.
Bye.
There you go, that was episode 5, Eagles, Eels and Elephants. I just want to give a massive, massive big thank you to Eric Lawler and Ruth Fitzpatrick one more time for being absolutely fantastic guests and Do you see what I mean with all the information that I learned? Like editing this podcast back, I learned so much. It was so good to kind of hear that all again. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. Another big shout out to Isaac's Hostel for giving us that space and allowing me to record an episode of my podcast there. It's fantastic. Don't forget, guys, you can follow Into the Wild on Instagram. Just search Into the Wild Podcast. We are also on iTunes. Just search Into the Wild. If you subscribe, I hope you do. And also, please give us a review. I'm really, really enjoying these reviews coming in and the feedback. It's absolutely fantastic. If you guys ever have any animals you want to hear about, you can email me at mrryanjdalton@gmail.com. If you've got anything you want to hear about, give us a shout and I'll try and arrange an episode to talk about it. But thank you very much for tuning in. We'll be here in a couple of weeks with another episode talking about three brand new animals along with two brand new guests with me as well. But in the meantime, keep living the good life, go out and see some wildlife and enjoy the rest of your week.